The division of government responsibility is clear. I was interested in Westland as a Secretary of State for Defence because we obviously procured helicopters for the defence interests from that company. I was not responsible as Secretary of State for Industry for the overall policy towards the industrial base. So at one remove, I knew about Westland's problems, and they were financial. They were in some considerable difficulty. Again, this was not my immediate responsibility to help the company to solve this, but in the way of things, and being a large customer, my department was drawn into the governmental dialogue to see if there's anything we could do, like, for example, paying our bills on time, or perhaps paying advance money towards development of new projects, whatever it was. I knew of the problems of Westland, although it was not my departmental responsibility. And that, I suppose, would have been in 1985, maybe a little earlier. I spent a lot of my time as Secretary of State for Defence negotiating with European colleagues the Eurofighter deal. And the outcome of that was that I was able to sign with the German, Italian and Spanish defence secretaries. I think one of the biggest deals Britain ever did, which was to do a joint development of the Eurofighter. So I knew the defence ministers, and I knew the senior officials in Europe. In, I think, October of 1985, I talked to Leon Britton, who was the Trade and Industry Secretary, who was responsible for Westland. And I said, look, I've just done this deal across Europe. Would you like me to see if I can find a deal that would help Westland? Because at that time it was becoming, the Americans were beginning to take an interest. And Leon said, yes, he'd be very grateful. And so I had the authority of the man responsible to hold discussions. I set out to do that. And they went well. Of course, if you're trying to bring other countries on board, it takes time. But it began to develop seriously. And then two British companies, two of our leading defence contractors, British Aerospace and GE, General Electric, joined in and became the lead party, so to speak. So we got a very serious grouping. At the same time, the Americans, under Sikorsky and UTC was the parent company, I think, wanted to sell the Ministry of Defence the Black Hawk helicopter. And this was a simple sales job, perfectly respectable sales job. But my department were adamant they didn't want it. It didn't meet their operational requirements. And I had black and white submissions from the Air Force saying, no, this is not what we want. But the American interest didn't go away. So you had this emerging issue, a British-led European consortium taking some time to flesh out their proposals. Because after all, if you think about it, they were talking about a brand new helicopter, a four-country partnership. Perhaps France was in, I think probably France was involved by that stage as well. Looking for a solution of quite an imaginative nature, whereas all the Americans had to do is to say, look, here's the helicopter, we want you to buy it. Anyway, this saga went on, and it became apparent, I think, that it was increasingly serious, that this British-led option should have a chance of being properly considered. The board of Westland were very keen on the American solution, and it's for them to explain why they were so keen. I can understand it. It was off the shelf. It was available, and there was just one company. The issue then began to become for ministers. The crunch point came when Margaret called a meeting of the ministers most involved, and that's a proper, perfectly proper thing to do. So this group of, there would have been Foreign Office, there'd been Treasury, there would have been DTI, there'd have been MOD in the room. And I put the case, the case for Westland was put, and Margaret lost the argument. Colleagues said I should be given the chance to develop the British-led European offer. Margaret was very cross about that, and she said she would take it to the Economic Committee of the Cabinet, which is, frankly, it's a very important committee. It's almost the Cabinet itself. And that meeting took place, again the same lineup, but much bigger, but including John Cuckney, the chairman of Westland, who had been brought in to try and influence the debate. Very, very rare for an outsider to be brought into a cabinet committee. But anyway, in he came. And they lost. The Economic Committee came out saying I should be given more time to develop the British-led European offer. Margaret was very, very cross at this, and in a very intemperate way, summed up by saying, very well, we will meet again at Friday after the stock exchange is closed in order to determine this matter further. I was quite content. I'd got the agreement of colleagues that they would look at any proposal that I put forward seriously. It's all I wanted. So the officials, the note takers in the cabinet committee, had been told to fix the meeting. And early the next week, they called round, put it in people's diary, the meeting would take place. On the Wednesday, they cancelled the meeting. And that was the point at which the row became difficult. I was quite clear that as a cabinet minister, first, I had won on the two occasions colleagues had discussed the matter. Secondly, I had a right to be heard in cabinet. I made it clear that if the cabinet, having heard my proposal, rejected it, I would accept that. This was not, people try to make it anti-American. It was not anti-American. It was simply, I had been asked by the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry to explore with European colleagues and British industry an alternative. And so my personal credibility as Secretary of State was in a very clear way on the line. You know, I'd gone out, I'd given undertakings, I'd told them that this was a serious offer that had to be properly considered. I didn't tell them it would work, but I said it would be properly considered. And here I was being told that, I'm sorry, the Prime Minister doesn't like this idea, regardless of what colleagues say, the game is over. Well, I wasn't prepared to accept that. And so there were a couple of cabinets at which I tried to raise the matter, and the last of them took place in early January of 1986, when Margaret refused to allow the matter to be discussed, and then she produced out of her handbag a manuscript piece of paper with a conclusion on it. Now, this is unheard of. I mean, the way that prime ministers are briefed, there's an official civil service brief, there will be a rehearsal of the likely arguments, and there will be two or three conclusions that she may wish to draw. And we've all of us who've chaired these committees know exactly how it works. It's a very sophisticated process, done having checked out all the arguments across Whitehall. Out of the bag came this piece of paper with the manuscript conclusion. And the manuscript conclusion was absolutely clear. The debate in public will now stop. Any cabinet minister who is asked any questions about this matter will refer the question to the cabinet secretary before answering them. And I knew when I heard this was a trap. So I said, Prime Minister, do I understand that if I am asked the identical question that I answered last week, tomorrow, I have got to refer to the Cabinet Secretary before I answer it, to which she said yes. Well, you know, I would have been a laughingstock. Time sort of rung up and said, Secretary of State, last week we asked you A, B, and C. This is what you said. What is your answer today? I've got to refer the answer to the Cabinet Secretary. I would have been the laughingstock, and what we now know, that would have been fueled by Bernard Ingham and Charles Pole, Margaret's apparatchiks in Number 10, because we know what they'd done with Paddy Mayhew's letter. And Charles Moore's book is fascinating, on his second version of, edition of Margaret's biography. He's obviously ashamed of what he discovered, and so anyway, that was the nub of it all. And when I heard that, I knew I had to leave the cabinet. The saga went on, of course, there was then a concert party to acquire the Western shares. The Americans got control. They failed to sell the Black Hawk helicopter, as I told them they would, and they sold the company back to the Europeans. The Americans never built the Black Hawk helicopter in this country. They never built anything that was relevant to the survival of Westland, having acquired it. So the one thing we know for certain is that the American ownership did not contribute to the future of Westland. What you cannot know, and I cannot know, is the precise form in which the European and British consortium would have... But the whole point of of Arnold Weinstock and British Aerospace was they wanted to get their own designed helicopter and their own manufacturing capability. That's what they were doing it for. So they would have worked out with the Ministry of Defence the requirements of the ministry and then produced it. My resignation didn't change the determination of the European and Brits to go ahead. And British Aerospace, under Sir Raymond Lygo, chief executive at the time, found that there was a holding of shares in Westland, I think in the hands of a bank, Fleming's, I think that's what it was. And they discovered this, and they were in discussion to buy those Fleming shares. I think that was on a Friday. If I remember correctly, over the weekend, James Hansen, who was a fan of Margaret Thatcher's, paid cash to buy those shares. And in short order, a group of people, which included, I think, Rupert Murdoch through TNT in America, and I forget, but later we discovered it was Jimmy Goldsmith, all of whom were the sort of people who had close supporting relationships with Mrs. Thatcher. They bought these shares. That's how America got control of it. It was a group of people acting in concert that did it. And we didn't even know this at the time, because there was always a missing factor, and that was the South American member of the consortium. And it was John Knott, who was, of course, a former Secretary of State of Defense and then chairman of the bank that acted for Sikorsky, who produced a biography revealing that, I think the words he used in the book were, Michael Heseltine never knew who the fourth member was. It was Jimmy Goldsmith. And that was in John Knott's book. It's not me. I didn't invent any of this. I mean, the issue is black and white. The MOD did not want the Black Hawk helicopter. The Americans made all sorts of promises but sold back to the Europeans when they failed to sell the Black Hawk helicopter. So all the things I said were true and were proven to be true. There isn't any other explanation except Margaret's obdurate resistance to anything that had a word like Europe associated with it. There is one moment which might have led to a different result. I could see the row brewing up, and there's always a possibility in vows of this sort that it's the dialogue of the deaf, that no one is actually listening to the other side. And I could see where it was going. And one day I said, look, there must be somebody I can talk to who can stop this nonsense. And there were two candidates. One was Willie Whitelaw, and the other was Quintin Hailsham, very distinguished senior figures in the cabinet. So I put a phone call through to both of them. And I think Quintin was America, and Willie was somewhere, God knows what he was doing, but I couldn't get through to either of them. I think if I'd got through, particularly to Willie, I might have been able to persuade him to get Margaret in a room with me and see where we go, you know. It might have been possible, but it didn't happen, so there's no point in crying over that. My opponents turned this into a great leadership bid, a great conspiracy, and all this stuff. It's complete fiction of their imagination. First of all, I didn't make any attempt to lobby the cabinet, and secondly, there was no thought in my mind of a leadership challenge to Mrs. Thatcher at that stage. And if there had been, I would have behaved in ways totally different to the way I did. A criticism of me, which is a legitimate one, is I didn't spend much time in the House of Commons. I wasn't in the tea rooms chatting up the members, and I wasn't. And I know I wasn't. I know why. Because I saw my job as to deliver the policies of the government, and I would be judged, in my view, by the Prime Minister on the success or otherwise of my job as a minister. I was not campaigning to be preferred by parliamentarians in any way. And that is a common judgment about me, and a criticism of me, that if you wanted to be leader, why didn't you go and make friends? And so I'm afraid the whole conspiracy theory that this was some design of challenging Margaret Thatcher has just got no grounds whatsoever. There's no truth in it at all.